Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
I think everything stopped in his life on Labor Day weekend of 89. I just don't know how that all stopped, and that's what bothers me. I really think that he died that weekend, but I just don't know why, how, who, and that's the parts that bother me.
On September 2nd, 1989, 40-year-old Ronald Salee arrived at a trail in the center of the Sierra National Forest in California, the heart of the Ansel Adams Wilderness. He was with two or three men he knew, and they planned to make the 4.9-mile hike to the San Joaquin River to camp and fish for the Labor Day weekend. Only Ron never made it to camp, and as far as we know, he never made it out of the forest. According to the friends, during the hike, Ron slipped, and when he got back up, he was acting strangely. Over the last mile to the river campsite, the group became separated. What this means is that Ron became separated from the others, and he never made it to the campsite. They fired shots into the air in an attempt to let him know where they were, but he never showed up, and he was never seen or heard from again. The story of what happened that day doesn't add up to a man who just decided to walk off into the forest forever. Almost 29 years later, his daughter Megan, who was just 6 when he disappeared, is still searching for answers as to what happened to her father. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 131 of The Vanished, Ronald Salee's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. It's important to begin by explaining that the original police file for Ron's disappearance is missing. When Megan contacted me about covering her dad's case, I submitted a record request. I was thrilled that it was approved, but my heart sank when I realized how incomplete it was. We have access to some reports and things that happened in recent years, but the original file and any witness interviews are gone. What I could see was that Ron's father had called to inquire about his son's case in the late 90s. When the detective went to retrieve his file, it was gone. From that point on, they had to piece together what they could. They were able to find an original Be on the Lookout flyer, which gave them some basic information. They also spoke to retired detectives who had worked the case a decade earlier. There's nothing to suggest that there's any sinister reason for the file to be missing. It's likely a result of routine disposal of old files, or files getting moved and discarded when officers moved on or retired. Both common in the past where files were closed or went cold. We must remember, as decades pass, it's easy to look back at ways of policing or record-keeping and criticize. But we also have to understand that before computers, paperwork was stored very differently. Ron's daughter Megan has only photos and little snippets of memories of her father. It's difficult for her to distinguish what are real memories or ones she's created from photographs and stories her mom has told her. Ron and her mother had divorced when she was a toddler, and she saw him every other weekend in the 3 years leading up to his disappearance. Megan isn't shy about the fact that he was abusive to her mother, and that he also abused alcohol and drugs. Those were the things which usually fueled her parents' arguments leading to their divorce. Ron, a Vietnam veteran, had a career as an x-ray technician. By all accounts, he was a smart man, but also a functioning alcoholic. The Ronald known to coworkers was probably a different man than the one he was at home. But at the end of the day, for Megan, looking back now, he was still her dad. He may not have been the best one, but he always made sure she knew he loved her. She doesn't remember the bad things. Over the years, Megan has struggled to come to terms with her own perception of her father and what others have told her about him. Since he's been missing for most of her life, she still sees him through that six-year-old lens. And Megan doesn't believe that he would just disappear to start a new life without her. In the months leading up to his disappearance, Ron left Ponca City, Oklahoma without telling anybody. He just picked up and moved. He went to California, where he was originally from, without telling Megan's mom or Megan. Here's Megan discussing what she's been able to piece together about those months.
According to the Detective Chavez, he was able to track down that my dad got a driving on suspended in Ponca City in May of 89. By September of 89, he had moved to California and was missing. So it was all within a rapid amount of time. He decided to move to California because his mom lived there, his sisters, and his brother lived there. So that's where his family was from. So he chose to move to California, and he left like literally everything behind. So I don't know where this begins. He had a Staffordshire Terrier that he bred. He took her and sent her to be bred. Never followed up with her. Took two greyhounds and clothes that he could fit into their crates. And that's all he took to California. I don't know if it was my mom or my aunt. Somebody got a hold of that landlord and they were like, yeah, it was weird. It was just like he had left the Olin Mills pictures of me and my brother. Like, my brother's not his biological son, but he had left our portraits and stuff, like, still hanging on the walls. Just left. But he was weird. Like, I don't know if that has anything to do with him disappearing, because he was just strange like that. Like, personal things didn't really matter to him.
Ron was originally from California, and his family was still there. He had a younger brother and two sisters. According to the police report, on September 2nd, 1989, Ron resided in North Fork, Madera County, California, a small community at the foothills of the Sierra National Forest, north of Fresno. It's also the exact center point of California. Leading up to the Labor Day weekend of 1989, Ron had begun what Megan describes as picking fights with his brother and sisters. His sister had borrowed some money from him, and he had suddenly called her, threatening he would harm her if she didn't give him the money back.
When all this happened, she said that right before he disappeared, like a week before he disappeared or so, he started calling her. And she said the one day he called, my son was having a seizure, so I didn't answer the phone. And he left a voicemail that said, I need my money or I'll kill you. So it makes me wonder if he didn't get caught up in something. He also picked a fight with his brother right before he disappeared as well.
Ron's brother, Megan's uncle, said that he and Ron were at a bar when they had an argument and Ron just walked off. He was never able to work out why Ron just snapped at him or what happened that night. When he went to find Ron, he was just gone. Ron had started seeing a woman, which, given he had only been in California for a short period of time, this was a new relationship, but it's believed that they were seeing each other at the time of his disappearance. That's the extent of what's known about the lead-up to the camping trip. Megan spoke about the last time her mom heard from him.
I guess he had called my mom at like 2 or 3 in the morning, like a week before he disappeared, and asked to speak to me. And she's like, I'm not waking her up, Ron. It's, you know, 3 in the morning. She's a kid. And he was like, well, I just need you to know, and I need her to know that I always loved you and I'll always love her. And that was the last time my mom even heard from him. So like he started acting really weird basically right before he left.
North Fork is less than an hour northeast of the city of Fresno, which for decades has been labeled the drug capital of America. According to alltreatment.com, the problem never slowed down, and by 2016, Fresno was the nation's leading intravenous drug city, with a drug rate 3 times that of the country's average. Although the city struggles with the use of heroin and cocaine, it's meth that quickly became the biggest issue. With the city being known for manufacturing the drug since its explosion in the 1980s, the remote expanses of the area has long made it a known hub for Mexican drug cartels, with labs able to go unnoticed for long periods of time. With long-term high unemployment and high poverty rates, Fresno and its surroundings were also hit hard by the increase in prescription as well as illegally manufactured opioids. So the drug problem never went away, it's just evolved and gotten worse. So, for a man like Ron, already struggling with drug problems, in 1989 he moved closer to his family, but he also moved into a well-known drug melting pot. Whether he got in with the wrong crowd or got himself into something he couldn't get out of, who knows? But something happened. There's just no answer as to what. On Saturday, September 2nd, 1989, the group of men, Ron and either 2 or 3 others, had decided on the Cassidy Trail as their weekend camping and fishing destination. With the original police files and interviews lost, we don't know exactly how many men were on the trip or even their names. On that day, it was around 96 degrees. There are several trailheads accessible from North Fork, Cassidy Trail being about one of 10 popular ones. The trail is almost exactly in the center of the Sierra National Forest. Why the group specifically wanted to hike and camp at the Cassidy Bridge at the San Joaquin River is unknown. Possibly because it was Labor Day weekend, and they would have time and space to camp and fish somewhere more remote. Possibly it was a favorite fishing spot. There's no indication whose idea it was or whether they had been there before. There was no mention in the current police documents that the men had visited or camped anywhere along the way prior to arriving at the Cassidy Trailhead. So it can only be assumed that they traveled in a car together from the North Fork region, a drive of approximately 2 hours northeast into the center of the National Forest and the north end of the Cassidy Trail. When they arrived at the trailhead on Road 5S84, they would have had to park at a place for hikers. It's known that it was Ron who signed the group in with a woman at the entrance, and it appears he may have signed in for all of them, that being himself and the 2 or 3 others. According to Ron's friend or friends, he was wearing a red and white striped tank top, cut-off Levi's shorts, white ankle-high hiking tennis shoes, and a straw cowboy hat. Ron was carrying a snow ski pole that he used for hiking, as well as a blue backpack and a red sleeping bag. The men were known to use drugs. It's unknown but possible that they were using at the time. According to the men who eventually reported Ron missing, they went for a swim at the beginning of the trail in the stream and Granite Creek before heading off. The trail had been well cleared and maintained. It's a 4.9-mile fairly easy hike to the Cassidy Bridge on the San Joaquin River, where they were headed to camp. At a relaxed pace without stopping, it would be about 2 hours, or about 2.5 hours with a break. Apparently, there was at least one handgun with the group. According to the Sierra National Forest Services, who gave us some information for this episode, national forests differ to national parks in that they are known as land of many uses. While national parks center around preservation, national forests, such as the one the men were hiking in, are used as necessary sources of both recreation as well as economic activity such as fishing, logging, mining, and hunting. So guns are allowed in the forest as long as they adhere to all state, county, and federal gun laws. In this case, fishermen with a valid fishing license can carry a gun, although they're expected to keep it unloaded until they arrive at their fishing spot. According to Ron's friend who reported him missing, although they were not supposed to have had the gun loaded along the trail or open fire along the trail, they had done what they referred to as target practice. Somewhere during the last mile of the hike, according to one of the men, something happened. Ron apparently dropped his pocket knife, and when he bent down to retrieve it, he slipped down a small hill or ravine. It doesn't seem like it was a big fall by any means, but when Ron came back, according to the friend, he was acting strangely. The men kept walking, and it was at this point that, according to the men from the group, they spread out and got separated. What this actually meant was that they spread out and got separated from Ron, or separated themselves from Ron. Here's Megan discussing what she knows about the trip.
and they all went fishing. And I guess that where they went fishing, they're like, you like sign in. And the guys made him go sign in. And like the lady said, she remembered him because he was like flirting with her almost. I don't really know how the setup is because I've actually never been to California. But when they got in, they said he dropped his pocket knife and he bent down to pick it up and he fell down like a, not a ravine, but like a side of the hill a little bit. And when he got back up and was able to climb back up the hill, they said he wasn't acting right, like he had hit his head or something. And they continued walking and they said at one point they got separated from him. And they went ahead and kept walking and built a fire for the night. And where they built their fire, they shot guns off into the air so that he would know where they were located. To me, that's all movie. Like, that doesn't happen in real life.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. So the men arrived at the Cassidy Bridge, a high wooden suspension bridge, which has since been replaced. They crossed the middle fork of the San Joaquin River. The terrain is rocky with small patches of forest and shrubs. It's not densely wooded, but the distinguishing factor is that it's covered in highly elevated granite rock, some as high as 5,000 feet. They crossed over and set up camp on the far side of the bridge. They started a campfire and shot several rounds into the air in an attempt to get Ron's attention. As the night wore on and the sun began to rise the next morning, Ron still wasn't at camp.
They continued to camp through the weekend. Never reported him missing, nothing, just continued to camp. But what I remember from the police report is that they have his wallet in evidence. So I don't understand how my dad would have had a backpack and a sleeping bag on his person, but not his wallet, if they had gotten separated. Because that just doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would you leave your wallet behind? But they continued to camp through the weekend, and then as they were coming out, they reported him missing. I guess after their camping trip, they reported him missing.
So as the men finished up camping and exited the forest back the way they came in, they reported Ron missing. This was Monday, September 4th. We need to rewind here a little and think about what may have occurred here. If the Cassidy Bridge is approximately a 2 to 2.5 hour hike at a relaxed pace, then at that point it could be reasonable to expect that the men camping may have thought that Ron left back to the exit of the park. The sun set around 7:30 and he was last seen, according to the men, at about 4:30 p.m. They may not have thought too much of it until returning to where they had to sign back out and saw that Ron had not yet signed out of the park. The police were notified, and although the file is missing, it's clear that at the time, the friend who reported him missing was spoken to by police and possibly others from the group. We have no indication if any of them were formally interviewed or interrogated. With the police documents that we do have, there are no names listed for the group of men. There's no report from the woman who signed the men in before they headed off on the hike. But Megan does remember bits and pieces from the original file because she had a chance to look at it years ago because her mom used to have a copy. We do know that 3 pieces of evidence were signed in. One was a spare ski pole given to the police by family, with the hope of matching it if the one Ron had with him was ever found. The second from Megan's memory is Ron's wallet, handed over by the friend who reported him missing. And there was also a third unknown item. Why or how the friend had Ron's wallet is unknown, and no explanation was ever given to his family, but it's something that Megan has always wondered about. Why did the friend have her father's wallet? After he was reported missing, a large search began. The police report states that it lasted a few days. Searchers went out on the trail, search and rescue was formally involved, and a helicopter was sent up. Apparently, horses also went down the trail towards the campsite, and the United States Forest Service also assisted. The general area down near the river, and in that last mile where he apparently disappeared, is rocky and has high limestone areas, as I said, some as high as 5,000 feet. The cliff faces down towards the river are steep, and there is also a lot of crevices. If he fell again on the actual trail, as the friend said he had already, then he would have likely been seen during the search, but it's possible that he wandered off track. He may have slipped and fell either off a cliff, into a ravine, or even into the San Joaquin River, or one of its offshoot creeks. There's also animals out there that could be potentially dangerous, like rattlesnakes, mountain lions, and bears. The possibilities there really do seem endless. Much of Northern California's border with Nevada is made up of national and state parks and forests. North of the Sierra National Forest, where Ron disappeared, is Yosemite National Park, and further north of that are parks and forests that go all the way up through Oregon, Washington State, and even into Alaska. Less than 100 miles south of the Cassidy Trail, and 7 years after Ronald went missing, something happened which could shine a light on the complexities of finding missing persons in this type of terrain. In the summer of 1996, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park's backcountry ranger Randy Morganson was stationed at Bench Lake. He had 28 years' experience as a ranger, which made Randy the most senior ranger in the High Sierra and was known to have unparalleled wilderness experience, survival, and rescue skills. He was known especially for being able to find people lost or missing. One day, Randy tacked a note to his station door to say that he was off on patrol duties for 2 to 3 days. He walked out into the park and was never seen alive again. He wasn't reported missing for 4 days, seeing as he wasn't expected back, and by the time the search began, rain had made it almost impossible to determine which direction he had gone. Randy had some troubles in his personal life. He had also made some unusual comments to friends and colleagues leading up to that day. And although planning to be out in the wilderness for 2 to 3 days, he left his Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum behind. He had appeared depressed to some that knew him, and so on one hand there was concern that he had disappeared intentionally, possibly suicidal. But there was also the reality that he may have had an accident and been unable to recover or save himself. There were also rumors of foul play. Randy was known for his distaste for hikers not respecting the wilderness, and had been threatened by people before. Like Ron's disappearance, the possibilities seemed endless. The search was extensive and meticulously planned. Thermal imaging helicopters were sent up, dog teams and search and rescue on foot. Around 100 people were involved in the search, which left no stone unturned over 80 square miles. Nothing was found. He had completely disappeared. 5 years later, on the outskirts of the original search zone, a local trail worker came across something below a waterfall and alongside a creek submerged in water. A piece of what appeared to be a shirt with Randy Morganson's badge on it. A backpack with a belt still clipped, indicating it may have never been taken off. The trail worker found a boot with part of a leg bone inside. Inside the backpack was a two-way radio, still switched to the on position. Looking back at the search records, it was clear that the area had been searched at the time. What happened to Randy before he died is completely unknown. Some believe he had wanted to disappear, but many rangers and those who work in the wilderness believe he succumbed to the forest. A terrible accident, falling through a snow bridge, breaking his leg and slipping under the ice. The most logical thing to them is that he may have been mauled by wildlife, and eventually what remained ended up on the lower end of the waterfall, unseen for 5 years. Just as the extensive search for Ranger Randy Morganson, the search and rescue effort for Ronald also came up with nothing. It was the end of the summer. The river was low at this time. There were parts where large rocks caused the river to stop and pool as opposed to run. It's possible that he may have fallen into the river and been swept downstream or trapped underwater by a boulder or rocks. But we must remember that in almost 30 years, no piece of clothing, no sleeping bag, no backpack, or the missing ski pole have ever been found or at least handed in. We do know that one person on the trip returned from camp in possession of Ron's wallet, which he would have likely either kept in his pocket or at least in his backpack. And something else strange was said when Ron was reported missing to the police. The friend described the contents of Ron's backpack. He stated that Ron had 2 packets of Pedialyte, a flashlight, and other specific items that indicated that he may have seen the inside of the backpack itself. One of the friends who was on that trip then went on to do something strange following Ron's disappearance. Here's Megan again.
When he left after reporting Dad and everything and going home, he moved in with my dad's girlfriend. And they started a relationship. My aunt tried to ask him what happened that day. And according to my aunt, he got a restraining order against the family so that he wouldn't have to talk to him anymore. I wish I could believe for 1 second that he legitimately hit his head and something went wrong in that time period. I don't. I have a hard time believing that. Yeah, I would never let a friend just wander off and then just continue camping all weekend not knowing where he's at. Because I think originally they thought that their story was correct. And I don't know that they've ever been investigated, honestly, because I don't know that there was ever enough evidence to investigate them for anything further. But during that search, I guess they had every exit that there was covered so that they would know that if he tried to exit, and they never found him, never found any inclination of him, nothing. I know that they had records of them all signing in, but I don't know if my dad signed them all in or what, because I guess the girl that was at the desk was saying, I remember him, he was flirting with me. So I don't know if he went up and signed everybody in as like, hey, these 3 people will be here from this time to this time or what. I've never gotten any clarification on that. And I'm not even so certain that that's how they do things today in that same area.
According to the United States Forest Service, little has changed in the way of entering and exiting national forests. Logbooks are still mostly written by hand, and the whole process of hiking in the forest is still what they refer to as a partnership. There's a mutual respect there. Signing in and out is a protection mechanism for hikers, fishermen, hunters, and the process still works well today. For Megan, one of the details of her father's disappearance has always made her suspicious, and that's the story about the gun.
I just have a hard time believing that they shot a gun up into the air so that he would know where they were located. And the only reason why that came up is because there had been reports of gunshots. And the guy's like, oh yeah, that gunshot was me. I shot it up in the air so that he would know where we were at. That doesn't make any sense. I've never bought that. I've always thought since I was a little kid that that didn't make any sense. But the guys are not cooperative. Like, they've been questioned originally. You know, they gave their stories originally. You know, and I've thought about several times trying to track him down and being like, hey, I'm Ronald's daughter, and I just want to know what happened. And just to hear the tone in their voice, you know, when they figure out, hey, he had a child. Did you know that? You know, like, because I'd have to wonder if they even realized it.
One detail that's still unclear is how well Ron even knew the guys that he planned to go camp with that weekend.
I think that he knew them for a short amount of time, but I feel like my aunt said that she had known them and they were friends of hers, just like his girlfriend was. That is why he just agreed to go fishing or whatever with them. He was from California originally, so I don't know that he didn't know him in the past, but I don't know how long he had been gone from California prior to going back. There's at least 6 years of my life, and then whatever more that he wasn't in California because he was in Kansas with my mom. So it's hard to say. And then the next problem is that he had warrants, or this new detective, Chavez, acted like he thought maybe he was running from warrants because he had a warrant in Dickinson County, Kansas, on a DUI. And then he had the Ponca City driving on restricted. And I was like, he's not going to run from that stuff. Like, that's not, he wouldn't have run to California to run from a DUI and a driving on restricted. Those aren't like major, huge crimes to run from. He wouldn't have run from that.
For Megan, she spent these 29 years not only wondering what happened to her father and running through all the possible scenarios, but also trying to cope with all the emotions that go along with having a missing parent.
All of this is just a lot to take in. You know, my mom was divorced from him and she's since remarried, so it's not like she wanted to live this every day. My aunts and uncles are all like, oh, he's alive, he's coming back one day. So they didn't live it every day. But I've literally lived this every day since I was 6 years old. I don't even tell people half the time because they look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, yeah, I feel crazy when I tell this story. I don't buy that he just went on a camping trip and hurt himself and never showed back up. I can't buy that. And listening to your stuff made me feel like I wasn't so crazy because other people are like, no, I'm not buying the story that's been given to me. I think everything stopped in his life on Labor Day weekend of 89. I just don't know how that all stopped. And that's what bothers me. I really think that he died that weekend, but I just don't know why, how, who, and that's the parts that bother me. Like, some things have come to light that I don't put past happening. I mean, but it's still kind of far-fetched. Like, my mom was telling me a while back when, because we talk about it every once in a while, she was saying that at the time there was a huge drug bust in the area that he was living at. She said, and I know from being married to your father, you put a little bit of alcohol in him, he talks way more than he should. She said, so I have to venture to wonder if these guys weren't, you know, paid to kill him for snitching. Or something like that. She said, I think that there's so many different avenues to go down with theories that it's hard to say what happened.
While Megan has always wondered if there was more to the story than what the friends ever confessed, Ron's family has come up with their own scenario to explain his disappearance. A scenario that doesn't seem likely.
My uncle was adamant that he was in witness protection. I don't buy any of that. I really think something happened to him. I'm not that person that holds faith that he's still alive out there. I really think something horrible happened and those guys got away with it because there was no evidence to suspect anything else. I just don't believe that he disappeared by his own accidents, like falling down the hill and something being wrong with him. I don't believe that that was it. He was in the medical field. He would have known if something wasn't right about it.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Although Megan's mom and Ron had been divorced long before Ron went missing, with no answers and no way to support Megan, her mom had to make a difficult decision.
7 years after he disappeared, my mom had a death certificate signed, but I don't blame her for doing that because she literally had no financial help. And the only way she was going to get financial help was his Social Security if he was declared dead. And I don't blame her for doing that. But I feel like that put a pause on the entire investigation. Because they're like, oh, there's a death certificate. They didn't look into why there was a death certificate. They're just like, oh, he must have been found. Like, it was never closed. It was still an open missing persons, but there was a death certificate. So I feel like it put a halt on a lot of things when she did that, even though I think it was necessary for her to do so. I will never forget how poor we were. Like, we found a place, a guy that would let us rent a house for $75 a month. Like, we shopped Goodwill. We stood in line to get commodities. You know, like, I will never forget how broke we were. And that's why I never blamed her for doing that, because it changed the way we lived every day immensely. And it was necessary. But I feel like it did end up putting a halt on some investigation, because when they opened up the new detective, because I feel like there's been a billion of them, each detective's like, oh, well, there's a death certificate signed. And then I have to sit there and explain to them why there is. Like, they don't fully grasp why that was done.
When Megan's mom filed to have Ron declared deceased, she received at least part of Ron's original case file, the one that's now missing. Megan had read it years ago, but hasn't been able to locate it for a long time. Since she did get a chance to read over it at one point, she has some memories of what information was in the file, but not enough to fill in the big gaps. While others who had known Ron seemed to be able to move on since his disappearance, Megan simply can't.
Of course, she doesn't want her daughter to go through this for the rest of her life, but she didn't have a lot of invested in it because he had done her pretty dirty a lot of times. I can't say that I would ever want to be a daddy's girl, and I think that my life probably ended up better without him and as an active member in it, but I still want answers, you know? That's hard to explain, because I do know who he was as a person, but I also know that I wouldn't want somebody to just let me disappear and never look for me, or never look for answers. You know, like, I can't be okay with just some random stranger taking him from me. I've run across so many brick walls in my path that I'm always expecting another one, constantly expecting to hit another wall. I don't put any hope in, like, when Namus finally got him in the system, no hope. Like, I don't get excited about those things anymore, because if I get excited about them, then I get let down, and I just can't do the letdown anymore. I used to hang on every little word, and you know, it caused a lot of grief with me and my mom because I did used to hang on every little word, but I don't anymore. And I know that he's gone, and I don't expect answers. It'd be great if one day I was surprised by an answer, but I don't expect it anymore.
One thing that Megan did do to try to get some closure was to hold a memorial service for her father. She planned the service with the hope that her father's family would make the trip from California. She knew it would be hard for them, since they've always held out hope that he would return, but Megan has always felt that he was gone. She's always believed in her heart that no matter what he did or what trouble he may have gotten himself into, he would have gotten in touch. He would have contacted her mom while she was growing up. And then into adulthood, she always felt something really bad had happened. Possibly something sinister, even. If for nothing else, Megan was hoping her father's family would show up to the memorial because she has always needed more support.
I never felt like he was coming back. Never once did I feel like he was coming back. And I held a memorial at my local church just for that little piece of closure. They refused to come because they could not go to a memorial for a man that they did not believe was dead. I think one of my aunts came. And it was like, okay, even if you don't believe it, I need that. Like, I need that for my own self.
We know that Ron's father had inquired about his son's case around the 10-year anniversary. He wanted to know if anything new had been discovered about his son. The detective at the time called the records department in an attempt to locate the original missing persons file. The detective was told that the file could not be found. He got in touch with the retired detective from the time that Ron disappeared and discovered that nothing new had come about. All they could find was a copy of the original missing persons flyer that was created in 89. Ron's father was called and informed that his son's file was missing. At the end of 2001, which was over 12 years after Ron had disappeared, detectives at the Madera County Sheriff's Office again looked into his missing persons case. They discovered that he wasn't listed in NCIC. The necessary information was then finally faxed over in order for Ron's name to be registered as a missing person in the NCIC database, 12 years after the last time he was seen alive. You may be thinking that maybe he just wasn't entered back in 89 because they didn't have the same technology that we have today. But NCIC has been collecting information about missing persons since 1975. They maintain files indefinitely until the person is located or the request is canceled by the entering agency. Having a missing person entered into NCIC is important because it's a way for any law enforcement agency to access information about a case. A missing person could be found on the other side of the country, and their information is readily available to law enforcement agents in that area. The state of California also has their own database. It's called the Missing and Unidentified Persons Unit, and it's run by the California Department of Justice. After they found that Ron wasn't in NCIC, they checked the state system and discovered he hadn't been entered there either. Fast forward to 2016. Megan noticed that her father wasn't listed in the NamUs database. She contacted NamUs directly and got the ball rolling to finally have him entered in the database, and also to give her DNA. This way, a familial DNA match could be made if a John Doe came up in the system. Perhaps with advances in file sharing between the states and jurisdictions, answers may come about somehow. The new detective handling her dad's case listened and helped her facilitate the process.
He'd swabbed me, my aunt, which is his biological sister, because the other one's only a half-sister, and then he swabbed my mom so that he could take the DNA from my mom away from my DNA to get a more better DNA, I guess, for my father's. I did submit that a year and a half ago. And so far, well, NamUs says that it's been tested, but not that the test hasn't been completed. According to Detective Chavez, it has been, and they didn't find any, like, unclaimed bodies that matched it, which I kind of expected. I don't expect any answers at this point. Like, it's gone on for so long. I would be shocked to find an answer at any point.
Although Megan has made some progress recently getting her dad listed where he should have been listed all along, she feels as though her dad's case wasn't taken seriously back in 1989 because of his lifestyle.
I feel like in 1989, first of all, they probably looked at these guys and were like, okay, well, you guys are drug addicts, and it was one of your drug addict friends that was with you, so we're going to focus on more important people. I mean, I feel like he brought that stigma on himself, and like I said, he may have been a functioning alcoholic or a functioning drug addict, but he brought that stigma on himself. And I feel like that stigma alone is where some of the seriousness in his case was lacking. I don't know. I just venture to think that they didn't put a whole lot of value in his life when, as far as they knew, he didn't have any children and he was just a drug addict that had gone with more drug addicts and disappeared.
Megan has toyed with the idea that maybe her father did go into a witness protection program. She's asked herself whether he did just want to disappear and forget about his previous life and forget about her. But she just can't reconcile this. Not after all this time to reflect. Ron, if he's still alive, would be turning 70 years old this year. Megan has never forgotten the year her father disappeared. It's still as clear as if it happened just yesterday.
Forever cemented in my mind, on the calendar in my grade school class, the year 1989. And it was like, for some reason, after my mom told me, it was like, this is the year my life changes. Like, this is, no matter what happens from this point forward, that visual picture of that calendar is forever cemented in my mind. And it was as if my world will never be the same after this point. Why he isn't calling, what happened, you know, like, because he used to call me all the time. And my mom didn't tell me about it right away because she didn't know how to. And she didn't know what was going to happen with it all. So she didn't want to be like, your dad went on a fishing trip and just didn't come back. So she was trying to wait it out and see if something would come of it all before she told me. And she couldn't wait anymore because I was like, why doesn't daddy call me anymore? That's how much he called me. So I'm forever stuck as that six-year-old waiting for the phone call.
So what happened to Ron during that hike along the Cassidy Trail back in 1989? Do you think that he just perished out there, perhaps after sustaining a head injury when he allegedly fell down while bending over to retrieve his pocket knife? Could a head injury have led him to wander from the group and maybe he got lost in the wilderness? There are many simple explanations for why people go missing in the wilderness. They can get lost, injured, or even become the victim of dangerous wildlife. Megan still has her suspicions about the other men who were on that trip. Was their story about shooting into the air a cover for the real reason they fired that gun? If they knew he had fallen and wasn't acting quite right, why didn't they keep a closer eye on him? Or could there be some other explanation? Would Ron have just walked away from his life? Megan is hoping that by getting his story out there, and really her story too, that someone will come forward with information. Maybe other hikers had been out there that weekend and saw something they didn't realize was important. Maybe the other men who were on the trip could come forward and help fill in the gaps about what happened that weekend. If you have any information about the disappearance of Ronald Salee, please contact the Madera County Sheriff's Office at 559-675-7770. That brings us to the end of episode 131. I'd like to thank Megan for speaking with me, and also the Sierra National Forest Ranger who helped us understand more about the hiking trail, their procedures, and the unique dangers that are present in the National Forest. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy the show, subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Your 5-star reviews help others find the show. Another way to support The Vanished is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. I will be taking next week off to go on a trip with my family, but I'll be back the following week with a case from Maine. Thanks for listening.
The only reason why I firmly believe that he disappeared and possibly was murdered that day, because I honestly can't think for a second that he would have left me behind and not thought twice about me. I mean, they had their animosities, but he would... You know, she was done with him. They'd been divorced 3 years, but at the same time, he'd go through these moments where he was like, I love you. I want to be a better person so that you'll take me back. And she'd have these fleeting thoughts about it. Like, they've been divorced, but she'd still have those fleeting thoughts like, okay, maybe he could change. But, I mean, obviously it didn't happen before he disappeared. They'd like to believe he's still out there in, like, witness protection, and he's going to just show up one day. I promise you, if he showed up today, I'd be furious. Because I've gone through this since I was 6 years old. I'm not going to be a happy camper if he's like, hey, I just want to be your father again. No. You've lost that right. All of this is just a lot to take in. But I have a lot of trust issues and a lot of abandonment issues. Like, I don't trust anybody to not walk away from me. And it's hard to explain it's not hard to explain. I know why I feel the way I do. But I honestly think that if he showed up now, it would probably mess me up more emotionally that he could walk away from me and not care what I went through for the last 29 years. And I just have a hard time believing that anybody would to do any of that and be okay with themselves.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.